The way I look at it is this. No matter what spiritual path we're on, we're in a path of devotion, we're in a path of whatever yoga, purification, whatever path we're on, what will be the fruit of that path? You know, we can discuss philosophy, we can talk about cosmology and theology, but for me, if we are on any kind of authentic path, we are going to come to a point where we feel a sense of peace and connectivity and love and harmony within our own body, mind, and spirit. And we are going to look around and see that we are part of a sea of humanity. And that the humanity that we are amongst is in all kinds of levels of evolution and life stream.
The path keeps unfolding, and so do the conversations that shape us. Welcome to the Free Radical Podcast, where we explore the sacred intersections of truth, love, and transformation. And today I'm more than honored to sit with a dear friend and brother, Sanan, who is a servant leader, a friend, community builder, deep listener, whose presence, in my opinion, speaks volumes, as you will see. So before we dive in, let me share a bit more about who he is. Sanan has been on his spiritual path since 1977, traversing a wide terrain with various teachers over the years. In 2009, he was guided to move to the Peruvian Andes to take the blessings and grace he had received on his journey and put into practical manifestation. He founded and runs a nonprofit service organization, including a school and other projects in his small village and the indigenous mountain communities nearby. So it has been a very rich conversation with a very dear, rich brother, talking about village, returning to village in terms of sharing in family, even if it doesn't take place exactly externally, but how to return to a village pattern, to learn to accompany each other in our journey, grief together. We talked a lot about grief. We talked a lot about love and what's really love means and how we many times in the name of love do exactly the opposite, how many times in the name of spirituality we just keep adding masks to our journey and how to deconstruct that. We talked about lots about Krishna, the sweetness of his name, his Leela, how to connect with that Leela in the here and now, how to be embodied and realistic in our spiritual project and do not engage in any form of escapism or bypassing, and the importance of relationship and demonstrate our love and dedication in the immediacy of the daily life and our relationships, and many, many other things apart from that. So this is the Radical Podcast, and to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel nourished by the conversation, feel free to like it, share it, drop your thoughts, so we can always continue with this conversation for what it is, an ongoing, endless dialogue between ourselves with reality. So without further ado, dear friends, here is Sanan. So dear Sanan, thank you so much for joining us to the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome.
Brother Swami Padmanabha, it is an absolute pleasure and honor. Thank you so much.
And I love you so much that you address me initially as brother. I really like to be one more in the family, one more in the tribe. I'm not so much of a hierarchical guy. And yeah, a few days ago, a friend of mine who is a Christian monk, he also said, like, can I call you brother Padmanabha? And I was like, yeah, of course. So thank you. Thank you for that being the very first word you mentioned today, brother. So can you remind me, Sanan, how we first connected originally? Maybe you have better memory than me, or maybe among the two we can recall how was our first online connection. We haven't met yet in 3D, though I look forward to visit Cusco at one point. But do you have any, I mean, a few years already we have been talking online, but maybe we don't remember, and that's fine.
It's been a few years, and this is the first time that we have ever done a video chat.
Exactly.
And how we met, I think it was through another devotee a couple of years ago.
Okay, whatever that is, no problem. It feels like we have known each other for a long time, and we never met in person.
Yeah,
that's important.
Yeah.
So I like to ask my guests, Anand, what brought you here today, apart from my invitation, of course, but what brought you today to the table for this conversation?
Well, when you invited me for this podcast, I was in the midst of so many things, and I just felt like I wasn't ready at the time. I said, just a few more weeks, just a few more weeks. And that was months ago. And so I have done in the 16 years that I have been here in Peru doing my work, I have done 3 interview podcasts. Mm-hmm. Only 3.
I'm very honored to be one of those 3 or 4. So thank you for that.
The third. And each one is about 5 years apart.
Okay.
And the last one was 5 years ago.
Okay. Those you guys who would like to have him in your podcast, you know, you have to wait till 2030 then. That's how it works. I'm having the exclusivity for the next 5 years on my podcast. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it tremendously. I am not a very polished speaker. I don't have a lot of experience in doing this. I was thinking I'm kind of like a fish in the ocean, you know, just swimming along with my service.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe once in a while the fish will stop and just kind of like analyze the water all around and, you know, discuss the ocean. But meanwhile, he's just swimming through.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and you keep swimming. I really appreciate that. And to be honest, I mean, the important thing is not to be a professional podcaster or guest for a podcast, but having a good heart like the one you have. So that's the main qualification, if we want to use that word. So, yeah, thank you. So, Sanand, your path has spanned, as you mentioned, you have been in Peru almost for 16 years, 15 years. You've been born in New York, if I'm not mistaken, or your childhood was spent there as well. Yeah.
Yes.
But now you're living in the Sacred Valley, in Pisac, specifically in Cusco, in Peru.
Yes.
So what happened from one place to another? You can tell us a little bit of your journey. Can you take us back to your early life in New York and how the journey eventually led to your service, to your sacred service in Peru now?
Well, first I have to give a little bit of a disclaimer. Please. I know there will be some many Vaishnavas who might watch this. And so I have to say that my path is very unconventional, and I am going to speak freely of all of the levels of my path, because I know that's your heart and intention. And so I am in no way able to even one minuta represent anything authentic in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, because I am very much a non-traditional path, and I am not in a box of any kind. And so what I am going to...
Sounds familiar to me. I could copy-paste your words and define myself almost in the same way. So,
so what I'm going to share is just my authentic path, and I will share things that are apasadanta and have... you know, nothing to do with Vedic tradition. And so please, for the Vaishnavas, please understand, I am just stumbling along in the best that I can. And I will just share freely and openly, and I will share, you know, what my journey has been. And I'm just here to enjoy this time together, really.
Yeah, that's why we are here. And thank you for that disclaimer. And I trust the understanding of the audience in Each one of us is in our own unique journey, which we cannot compare with anyone else's. And yeah, some more traditional, less traditional, more in the box, more in their own box, outside of any box. So yeah, but for me, the bringing you and other guests to the table and this podcast is also to bring different voices and different ways of not only living Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but some people from other traditions, or no fixed tradition in one sense, but let's just meet a genuine human being and see what we can learn from that. So I trust that's already happening. So thank you.
Okay, so my first recollection of my spiritual path was when I was 13 years old, and I started studying the works of Swami Vivekananda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
I have some friends from the Ramakrishna Mission, and they indeed came to my podcast.
Yeah. I was 13. I don't know how I got the book, and then a little bit of Paramahansa Yogananda. And then I just started my journey at the time. I was living in Manhattan in New York City. And then a few years later, I was in another country, and I met someone who was trying to recruit me into their tradition.
Okay.
And he was telling me all of his past experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said he was, you know, did yoga, he was with the Hare Krishnas. And as soon as he said Krishna's name, it was like ding, 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 ding. I was like, what? Hare Krishna, seriously? And so
you didn't know about Hare Krishna till that point, but the word sounded to you?
I really didn't remember any connection with the devotees or Krishna at all. But
I was wondering, being born in Manhattan, there were, I assume, many of them around by the time you were born, so probably some. But yeah, maybe direct and conscious, whatever. Sorry.
My mother told me when I was a little boy, we were in front of the Natural History Museum, and there were devotees doing Harinam.
Mm.
And I asked my mother, "Mom, who are they?"
Mm.
And she said, "The Hare Krishnas."
Okay.
That's what I remember. She told me that. Mm. And so I didn't remember really anything about the devotees, but when I went back to the United States, I immediately called information and I said, "Hare Krishna Temple, please."
Mm.
And they gave me the phone number of the 55th Street Temple.
Mm.
This was 1979.
Mm. So 2 years after Srila Prabhupada had passed.
It was about a year and a half or 2 years, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I went right directly to the 55th Street Temple.
Mm.
And I met a devotee named Kurma Rupa Das.
The famous cook? Or maybe there's someone else with the same name,
He ended up living in Vrindavan.
Oh, Kurma Rupa. Yeah. Kurma Rupa with the cow, care for cows and so on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry. I mix it with another Kurma, a famous Kurma. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, beautiful. You met with him.
Yeah. And he was such a sweet devotee.
Mm.
And so he gave me private Bhagavatam lessons and taught me how to chant japa.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me out on the street to distribute back to Godheads.
Mm.
So I would go and distribute back to Godheads on the street, because I was immediately in love with the devotees.
So if I may ask, how old were you at that time? Like, let's say 79, 80.
Well, I was 16 in 1978.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I was 16, yeah.
Mm, okay, young.
Then I would go back to the temple, and the Govinda's restaurant would fix me a huge plate of prasad.
Of course.
I mean, a huge plate of prasad.
You are being clear in your graphic depiction. You are not exaggerating. We want to make it clear.
Yeah, I just want to be clear.
Yeah.
And that was my life, chanting and associating with the devotees. And I almost dropped out of high school to join the temple.
Almost. That didn't happen.
It didn't happen. So my path continued for many years. I was in high school in Massachusetts. I also met a devotee from the Boston Temple who also gave me Bhagavatam lessons and brought me these Govinda bars.
Okay.
And I again almost dropped out of high school a second time to travel with the devotees. But I didn't. And then basically I did meet various different swamis that came from India. At that time, there were many swamis coming from India. I met all kinds of very unique, eccentric swamis that came over. And my path was very varied.
Disclaimer part two, just in case you didn't hear the part one.
Before, in 1982, I actually came across Rajneesh.
Okay, Osho.
And I went to college in Vermont, Bennington College. And after 1 year, I dropped out of college. And I ended up going to live in Oregon at the the Rajneesh community in Oregon at the infamous.
Yeah, I watched the documentary.
I haven't watched it yet.
Okay, you've been there. You've been there.
No problem. I was there.
Okay.
And so I know there was all kinds of drama and horrible things that went on. And I make no excuses for any of it. Really, in all of the sanghas that I had been connected with, there was all kinds of crazy things going on.
Sounds familiar, yeah.
I mean, even in the Vaishnava communities and in Osho community and in other communities I was part of, there were things going on that I had no idea about. And one of the things in my path that's been very special is that I was just a seeker of truth. And even though there was craziness going on all around in the organizations, I knew nothing about it.
You were too concerned seeking the truth.
I was just completely devoted. I wanted to find out what the essence was of these teachings. So when I was chanting japa and listening to Krishna's sweet names, I just wanted to hear the names. I just wanted to read Srila Prabhupada's books. I was reading the Nectar of Devotion, and I was reading the teachings of Queen Kunti and Beyond Birth and Death and the Krishna book and the Bhagavad Gita. And I was, you know, experiencing that first sweet taste that Krishna gives us when we are encountering the holy name. And so one interesting thing is that throughout all of my journey and all of the different sanghas and communities and teachers I've been, I've always been chanting the Maha Mantra. Even when I was in the Oregon community with Osho, I was chanting japa. And I thought, how interesting that I have brought the holy names, the Maha Mantra, as a steady, continuous point of reference throughout my entire journey. So.
And we will say that the name of Krishna is none different from Krishna. So it's a way of course, carrying Krishna with you all along the journey, him accompanying you.
Exactly. And I really was open-minded. After 1 year of college, I went to live in Oregon with Osho. Then I went back to New York. And then I started studying natural healing. microbiotics and homeopathy and natural healing. I just wanted to heal myself. I started my journey of holistic healing. Mm-hmm. I had become a vegetarian when I was 16 in high school. Mm-hmm. Because there was a girl that I had a crush on, and she said, you know, you're not a vegetarian. And the next day I was like, oh, yes, I am.
I am, yeah, of course. You subscribe to the contract very quickly.
I was like. And so basically what happened was I moved to another ashram in Virginia, a disciple of Muktananda. Mm. His name at the time was Brother Charles.
Okay.
And he had he integrated the use of whole brain technology and alpha theta states, mm-hmm. with deep subconscious reprogramming for consciousness and awakening. Hmm. And so I lived there for 9 months.
This was in the 70s, right?
No, this was 1980.
Okay.
Well, at that point, it was 1985.
It's okay. I don't want to accept years. Just have a general idea of the timeline. Yeah.
It was late 1985, exactly.
Okay.
And during my time there, I was doing a kind of a regression, like a therapeutic regression work. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Reiki, kind of like a deep breath work and like rebirthing and emotional release. Mm-hmm. And I had a vision that I was going to go to Santa Cruz, California, mm-hmm. and that I was going to be on a journey and that I was going to write a book and I was going to meet people I had been with in past lives, mm-hmm. and that I had a journey that I had to go on. Mm-hmm. Wow. So I moved to Santa Cruz, California. So I went to a rainbow gathering in Big Sur. Mm-hmm. And I drank mushroom tea and peyote tea.
Okay.
And I had quite a spiritual awakening because I had done quite a bit of yoga and Chinese herbs and purification and cleansing and spiritual practices. And so then when I drank the mushroom and peyote tea, I had quite an awakening. Hmm. So I came back from the rainbow gathering. At that time, Santa Cruz, California was literally like the 60s were still going on. Mm. So I came back from the rainbow.
20 years after, still the 60s were going.
Well, yeah, it was still going. Santa Cruz, the Grateful Dead was happening, mm-hmm. rainbow gatherings. I mean, it was like pretty, yeah. It was pretty happening.
Yeah, okay.
It was like the tail end of the 60s and mm-hmm. the Grateful Dead and like,
yeah.
So basically what happened is I woke up a few days after that rainbow gathering and I woke up in the middle of the night and I reached for my diary and I started writing. And I woke up the next morning and I was like, what the heck? What happened last night? And I looked at my altar, it was a mess. Mm-hmm. And I looked at my diary and there was all this information had come through. Mm-hmm. And basically what happened is, well, I ended up writing a book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know about that. Emergence. Yeah,
exactly.
Was the subtitle? The Awakening of the Planet Earth. Okay. So you fulfilled the prophecy, the vision. You wrote the book.
Yeah, I wrote the book.
That was in the 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the book. That was the final copy. There's another copy which I could retrieve. There were different versions that came through.
I can see the different color, yeah. And the different design, yeah.
So there was a rainbow gap. There was a Grateful Dead show. Mm-hmm. And my friend said, hey, Sanan, what's going on? I said, well, the other day I woke up in the middle of the night and I started writing, and I made copies for you all.
So
I shared them with the copies for everyone. And then this final version we printed, it ended up being in bookstores. And somebody gave me a donation to publish 5,000 copies. So I would go to different events and just distribute the copies, just pass them out.
Okay.
It was kind of like a new age, be here now.
Ram Dass.
So what happened was in 1988, I was skateboarding around Santa Cruz. And someone said, I was going by the name Jivan Suluk at the time, which was my Osho name.
Okay.
It meant search for God in life.
Hmm.
Which was really good for me because before I was very much in an internal path. And what Osho taught me was really to be in my body and process trauma and feel and really experience life and not be contracted from life. And so for all his shortcomings.
I appreciate that advice, definitely.
I have not renounced any of my gurus. I have just continued and taken all of their grace and blessings and teachings and continued on.
I can resonate with that as well. Yeah.
So someone came up to me and said, you've got to meet this woman from India. My hair was down to there. I was skateboarding around Santa Cruz. And he brought me to a living room.
Okay.
In that living room was Mata Amritananda Mayima.
Ama.
There was maybe one of her swamis and two or three associates and maybe one other person. This was her second visit to the United States.
I see.
At that point, I immediately fell in love with her.
And I assume you were embraced by her very deeply.
We spoke for maybe 45 minutes because there was nobody there. This was before she was famous. Now there are thousands of people everywhere she goes, of course. And she hugged me and asked me questions, and I became her devotee. And I brought all of my hippie friends and Grateful Deadhead friends to her. And we had many special pastimes. I would make these sweet balls and offer it to her and then distribute the prasad to the devotees. I ended up bringing hundreds of people to her, and I was very close with her for many, many years. So that was in Santa Cruz, and my path continued with the holy name and with Osho and all of the different teachers I had. I was just kind of like, I just kind of like took it all and digested it and shared my book with, you know, many people. And just, I was pretty much just a hippie. And what happened was, at that point, I was also very much within the whole New Age. And, you know, at a certain point in 1980, well, I'm sorry, 1990, I got the message that I wanted to leave the United States and go to another culture. And I wanted to take what I had learned and what I had gleaned and the gifts I had received and bring it to do something with it. But the guidance I got was I had another decade of work to do before I was going to be allowed to go anywhere. So I became an environmental activist. I'm not going to mention what kind.
Okay.
But it has to do with air quality. I'll give you that kind of hint for those who might understand what I'm referring to. And what's going on in our skies. And stuff like that. And so I shared my book, continued my path, was always chanting my japa all throughout. And then I moved up to Ashland, Oregon. And at some point, I was guided to visit Peru. This was in 2008.
You'd never been to Peru before?
No, I didn't speak Spanish. I had never been here.
Okay.
And basically, I knew I wanted to go to another culture. And so my friend and I went. He paid for the ticket. And I came here and visited for a week. 4 months later, I came back and went through the Sacred Valley. And I hiked the ruins. And when I came down, I got this message in my heart that I was going to live here in my village of Pisac. I knew nobody here.
Okay.
Just one non-local person.
Yeah.
And I didn't speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to Ashland, Oregon. I packed up my stuff. I said goodbye to everyone. I left. I didn't end up coming back to visit for 8 years to the United States.
Okay. You had a call. You had a call there.
I had a call in. Oh, yeah. So when I got here, I really didn't know exactly what I was going to do. I thought I was going to maybe establish an eco-village. So when the whole world was going to collapse sometime in the future. At that time, it was the future.
Yeah.
That I was going to be the hero and I was going to have an eco-village for all my hippie friends to come and live. But Krishna had other plans. So what I did was I did my 13th ayahuasca journey. This was 15 years ago. That's the last time I did ayahuasca. And I do not, I don't smoke ganja. I don't do ayahuasca. I don't smoke. I don't drink alcohol. None of that is part of my life anymore for years, a long time. And I never smoked cigarettes, but I did smoke ganja. And I never drank alcohol. But now I am, for many years, I don't do anything. But in that ayahuasca journey, I was completely broken down. I did not know why I was on the planet. I did not know what my purpose was. I did not know what I was doing. I had no idea what I was supposed to do. And I was crying and just praying for hours and hours.
That was in Peru, right?
Yeah, that was here in Pisa.
Our second visit to Peru, yeah.
No, that's when I moved here.
Oh, when you already moved, yeah.
Yeah, I had moved.
Okay.
And I was here. And I drank ayahuasca.
Okay.
And I wanted to get some guidance. So in that, after hours and hours of just deepest pain and repentance and tears and just absolute, I was completely broken.
Broken down, but I would say broken open also, right?
I was broken open.
Okay.
I had to be completely broken open to receive my message.
That and in itself is a message.
Exactly. And so finally, I got the message. And the message was, take care of my children of the Andes in the times that are coming. and all of my sadness turned to joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next day, I had not told anybody anything about what happened. And all of a sudden, the children started coming around.
Mm.
I was like, what the heck? I hadn't told anybody anything that happened. And they started coming around as if they knew something.
Mm.
Oh, God. I was like, they were like, yeah, and?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay. What are we going to do? We're buying crayons and colored pencils, and the girls are going to make fruit salad, and let's get this going.
Mm. It all begins with some crayons and fruit salad, right? You have to begin somewhere.
Yeah, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's how this school started.
Hmm. Wow.
And it grew and grew, and we started having different classes, and we changed location a few times. This was 2000, basically 2010.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 15 years ago.
Yeah, 15 years ago.
Yeah. And a lot has happened between that and now, for sure.
Well, what happened was the guidance that I got was don't worry about understanding what's happening. Just be of service continually.
Another big lesson there, right? We try to understand things too much sometimes, and that gets in the way of giving ourselves in service.
I was not supposed to understand what the vision was, what the goal was. Just be of service and create the social connectivity with PSAC, that love and trust and connectivity, because you will find out later. I will find out later why.
Mm-hmm.
So I took care of the children. We grew our school, gradually grew, brought in teachers, started taking care of the grandmas and the grandpas, you know, just started connecting with the village and just grew myself and grew our service over 15 years.
Mm. I'm wondering, Sanat, thank you so much, of course, for such an incredible timeline and still unfolding, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you've done this, and you mentioned you received this message, okay, change of culture, right? Because, from New York to PSAC, there is quite a difference in in paradigms and worldview and culture. So I'm curious, you've already shared some nice, beautiful pieces of wisdom. What has been some of the most inspiring and humbling lessons you've received from indigenous elders in the particular culture of Peru, where you are?
Well, you know,
not necessarily the elders, but the culture. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What I realized throughout my whole journey was that I wanted to step outside of the spiritual bubbles and the mm-hmm. sanghas that I had been part of, whether mm-hmm. it was Vaishnava sangha or some other sangha or hippie sangha, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
because it was really kind of like really like a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And so my guidance the whole time when I was in the U.S. was I wanted to take all of the grace and the love and the blessings I had received, and I wanted to go and do something with it.
Mm.
So I'll wind back around to your question, but for the devotees, imagine this. Going to another culture where you didn't speak the language and you knew nobody and you were on some kind of mission and all you had was the holy names.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any books. I didn't have any association. I didn't have any forum or context or community. I just had the holy names.
Mm-hmm.
And just to get back to the holy names.
Of course, right? Just. But I get you. No. I totally get your point. I was just clarifying that.
And it's just one of the proofs of the incredible, inconceivable mercy mm-hmm. of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, mm-hmm. that even without any association, any mm-hmm. books, any kind of temple, just the holy name, even if you're out in a wilderness, even mm-hmm. if you're out in a foreign land where you're like, don't know anything, anyone, the holy name, how could it be that the holy name, the potency of the holy name could be with us unless it was real?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been chanting this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that. The other yeah. thing is that what I realized coming to Peru is that the first world has so many levels of conditioning and so much trauma and so much toxicity and so much destruction that I just had to get out. And when I came here, winding back to your question,
yeah.
is I found the reflection of pure souls.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like, for me, this was like coming to something like Vrindavan.
Yeah, yeah. In many ways, I will say Peru is very much like the India of South America. The traditional villages or places like where you've been. Yeah, yeah.
The sweetness of the village, just mm-hmm. like Vrindavan,
mm.
you know, without all the conditioning of the first world,
mm.
you really get to find out what is, you know, humanity in its natural state, a little bit closer to just reality, to the beauty of just humanity, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The very setting, sorry to interrupt, I'm reading this book now, maybe you've heard about it, if not, it's recommended. It's called The Wild Edge of Sorrow, and it says Rituals of Renewal and the Sacred Work of Grief. So it's a book revolving around grief and the need for grieving and creating ritual and space, but it's a lot about returning to, as much as one can, to a village setting, even if you cannot do it physically, but building sacred space and sharing with community, and how much that resembles the natural way to live and to relate. So I was just thinking about that when I was hearing you, yeah.
Exactly. And in order to come back to our pure essence and our natural mm-hmm. state, our imperfect, humble, stumbling, you know, imperfect human personality and experience, we actually have to, what is the word in that book? What is the title of that book?
The Wild Edge of Sorrow.
Right. We have to go through the sorrow of feeling all of this sadness, mm-hmm. of releasing all of the trauma and the layers mm-hmm. of sadness and misdirection and toxicity that we have inculcated in our journey.
Yeah, whether from our own personal journey, grief from our ancestors, things that have been passed in family systems that remain unresolved, so much.
All of it. And this is, you know, this is what really activated my heart and my soul here, to see the children and see the elders and see the people here. You know, they are not perfect.
Yeah. Who is?
And so what I realized was that there is a purity here and that the indigenous people have a purity that those of us from the first world have lost. And so my purpose here, I have realized, is being an interface with the first world rather than the crap that they are receiving on the television, on their cell phones, all of the bad food and the toxic food. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is coming over here too.
I can, yeah, yeah.
You know, this is Kali Yuga everywhere. And so my purpose here is to be an interface with the positive aspects and to kind of guide them, share rather, not guide. I don't like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like be a reflection of something that's different from what they're seeing on TV and their cell phones, and help them to just just to share some, like a brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brother Sanan, of course.
So in our school, we teach them about cell phones, and we don't use cell phones, and we teach them about healthy food, and we just have a healthy consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. That has been a big part of what the journey is. And mm-hmm. really, it's just been like reactivating my own heart, reflecting their beauty.
It's not that you feel that you went there to do them a favor, so to say. Of course, it's reciprocal, no. Always back and forth, but I'm sure how much you feel you have received from them.
It's been more than reciprocal. Mm-hmm. I have been able to become part of my village because I have no other life, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So since I had no other life, I was supposed to just be of service and, you know, learn and grow as I was connecting and growing our projects. We have a school in PSAC. We have anywhere from 50 to 70 children every day coming. Mm-hmm. We have classes in science and math and Andean culture and singing and weaving and art and handicrafts.
And lots of food also, I must say, by the pictures I see.
Yeah, lots of good, healthy food. Yeah. And we offer it all for free. And there is nothing like what we have in PSAC.
Mm. So Sanan, the name of the project, if I'm not mistaken, is Amistad Sagrada.
Amistad Sagrada is the name of my nonprofit organization.
Oh, okay. I see.
Which
means sacred friendship.
It means sacred friendship.
I see.
The name of the school.
Yeah.
The name of the school is Yachai Wasicha.
Mm.
And that means the little house of learning.
Mm, beautiful. We are always learners, students forever, as Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say.
Absolutely. Yes.
So regarding going back to Amistad Sagrada or sacred friendship, and I'm having the link here. One second.
The website is very outdated.
Okay. So here it is, Amistad Sagrada. And of course, those who would like to know, you have a Facebook, which is Sanan, S-A-N-A-N, PISAC, P-I-S-A-Q. So then you will, you are always posting there lots of news about the project and new festivities, celebration, sharing of food. And so it's very up to date, at least the Facebook page. If the website is not that updated, the Facebook page, you keep that very active for sure.
The website is pre-COVID, and my Facebook page is where it ended up being the current documentation of our project.
Yeah.
And anyone's welcome to connect there.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, but Amistad Sagrada, sacred friendship. What do those words mean for you? Amistad Sagrada, sacred friendship, not just as a name, but as a guiding spirit, so to say.
Well, what our projects are, we have also projects in the indigenous communities as well, in two of the communities for now. And basically, that's a beautiful question. Basically, though the manifestation of our projects is a school, and we have classes in the communities, and we have other activities, basically, it's the relationships that we have built and the love and the trust that I have built with all levels of society here.
Mm-hmm.
With all humility.
Which I'm sure takes time also, right? It's a gradual process.
It's been a very gradual process. It has been had many, many challenges, and there has been many tests. I mean, incredible tests. I mean, this has been a very authentic journey.
Okay. I appreciate you are bringing that, because if not, sometimes the audience can have a very overtly romanticized idea of, landed in Peru and everything just blossomed
simultaneously. Not at all. I have been tested to my core. Personally, I have had to address all, like every nook and cranny of every trauma and conditioning, everything that has come up in my own quirks and personality aspects in the journey. I've had to address virtually every speck of my consciousness, my past, my regrets, my sadness, my traumas, you know, my conditioning, my belief systems about everything in order to be able to show up. And really, you know, it's like the way I look at it is this. No matter what spiritual path we're on, we're in a path of devotion, we're in a path of whatever yoga, purification, whatever path we're on, what will be the fruit of that path? You know, we can discuss philosophy, we can talk about cosmology and theology, but for me, if we are on any kind of authentic path, we are going to come to a point where we feel a sense of peace and connectivity and love and harmony within our own body, mind, and spirit. And we are going to look around and see that we are part of a sea of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that the humanity that we are amongst is in all kinds of levels of evolution and life stream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's life stream, not live stream.
Yeah.
And we are going to find out that, you know, people are sad and suffering and hungry and lonely and lost. And the conditioning of the modern world is distracting them and conditioning them. And people are trying to just survive. And so if we are on any kind of authentic path, it will be inevitable that we are going to feel our heart, our connection with life, and our connection with our brothers and sisters.
Which implies connecting with their sorrow in big part, and their, through that, with our own sorrow and grief a lot.
It's going to meet them in their humanity, in our humanity, and...
And you are there with in a community, communal setting, right? So, and for me, grieving is something you can do by yourself. You need a vessel, you need support, you need community. So we need each other to go through all those rough waters. So
in order to...
Most communities bond and build up on many times shared suffering, most than any other experience, so to say.
Absolutely. In order to have that love and trust, you have to be like any relationship. You have to be there in the beauty and the sadness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Birth and death.
Yeah. An integration of polarities. It's not black and white, but it's black, white, and all the varieties of gray in between, so to say. Yeah.
3 weeks ago, a 14-year-old boy... someone who taught chess in our school lost his life. Dear friends of mine, the village is very raw. It's very real. Everything is very close to life. And so, you know, the children and the elders and their health conditions and their sadness and their loneliness, it's like... For me to bond and to be here, I've had to go through my own journey. And, you know, love is like you were saying, it's like being there in any relationship with all of the flavors of the journey. That is the extent of my devotion to the people here.
I appreciate you mentioned that, son, and also that love, because sometimes we have our own ideas about love. Love is a word that is beautiful, but we can have a very, very shallow idea of love, like just feeling good, right? Or feeling honeymoon-like. And I'm not saying that's not part of the whole thing, but there's so much more there. And there's grief, and there's pain, and there's loss. And love can and should enter in each one of those spaces. No, and there's celebration and beauty and laughter, but also in our tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnava Medicine World will say, even in the eternal rasas or emotional dispositions to experience, not only there is servitude and friendship and romantic love, paternal love, but there is anger, there is fear, there is sadness, there is, I don't know, astonishment. So there is a whole big spectrum of emotions, and we don't need to discard any of them.
Right? Exactly.
In the name of love, especially in the name of love, we don't want to discard them. I'm pursuing only love, so I want only to be happy. I want only to enjoy. I want only to this. I don't want to do anything with grief, with sorrow. No, that's a very special way in which love shows up. And we show up for love, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I took a few notes of things that I wanted to make sure that I spoke about.
Okay.
And so I just want to just really quickly just go through them, just because I'm not used to speaking about these things. This is like where I'm like a fish right now, swimming through, and now taking a moment to talk about the water.
Go to your notes in the water, no problem.
So something you just said, you know, like one thing is like, you know, in the new age or within the community of ceremonies or like therapies or retreats, PSAC has become a vortex of like retreats and plant medicine ceremonies. We're famous for it.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I've noticed is that we can work on ourselves and work on ourselves and deal with our traumas and drink medicine and do therapies and heal ourselves. And especially in the first world, everybody's so messed up, so traumatized. And we're all, you know, just searching naturally, you know. I don't mean that in a judgmental way. I am also the same. And so, but why are people doing retreats and ceremonies and therapies? Because the first world, there's so many levels of conditioning that they just want to peel away the conditioning. That is my conclusion, is that, you know, oftentimes we can be on a spiritual path and we can join a religion or a sangha or even a lineage. And we can take a new name and have a new culture, and we can paint it on top of our traumas and our sadness and our fears and all of our hurts and our wounds and our subluxations in our spine and our parasites and our clogged liver and all of our confusion and sadness, and put on the Shanti and the Ananda.
Yeah, dress trauma with sacred robes.
And we see this so much within the new age. And I went through years and years of this also. So I know that the real pain of having a disconnection between who we really are and all of who we are, and then wanting to be spiritual and reading about the goal and all of the beautiful leelas and all of the beautiful words of the saints and the sages, and wanting that so much because we can remember and resonate with that and long for that. And then we put on these masks and these coverings, and we have the dress and the beads, and we have the new name, and we have the new diet, we have the new sangha, and it's Om Shanti, and we're on the path until...
And just wait for one more week or 2 weeks and realize that most of the stuff is still there waiting for you to work on.
This is one of the things that Osho taught that I immediately resonated with, is that until we deal with all of the levels of our being and are authentic and able to feel again, because we've been taught not to feel and to process, that we can be sitting in meditation on top of a volcano. That is, like you said, that it's just in 1 or 2 days or weeks is going to erupt.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I like to say in my book, Radical Personalism, we should sit with our emotions and not sit on top of our emotions. And in the name of transcendence, we shouldn't be indifferent or engage in spiritual bypassing and practice disembodied spirituality and things like that.
Exactly. And that's why oftentimes the New Age spirituality also becomes like narcissism. It becomes a total focus on ourselves, trying to heal or ceremony our way into enlightenment. And this is one thing that I've realized.
And it's I can imagine how much you see that in the area where you are living in Peru, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Sincere seekers for sure, but also unconsciously doing some form of escapism instead of being willing to confront and integrate what needs to be made part of the wholesome equation.
Exactly. And not only here, but I came from that, living like 23 years in the Bay Area, in Santa Cruz, California, and Oregon, right in the heart of the whole New Age movement. Mm-hmm. I was immersed in that even before I came here. So what I realized was that we can have a trauma that we're working on for years or decades, some kind of trauma from our parents or a relationship, or it might be unspecific. And we can be working on that with therapies and engaging with that as our central star, trying to become enlightened, trying to heal ourselves, trying to like become whole again. But until we are in right relationship with the universe, which is being of service to humanity, we will never be able to heal ourselves into enlightenment. And that once we offer ourselves in service, that it's not like that trauma or that wound goes away. It's just no longer this sun. It just takes its proper orbit.
Yeah, it's put into its place. Yeah.
Because if there's somebody suffering to our left or to our right, and we are all self-fixated trying to heal ourselves, what are we going to say? There's some child asking for an apple, and it's like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have time. I'm going to my yoga class.
I'm healing my trauma, so you have to starve. Sorry. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that is one polarity.
Yeah.
Now, the other polarity I found is in the spiritual, especially the Eastern sanghas, where we have like devotion and self-forgetting and serving Gurudev and being of service in whatever way and just forgetting ourselves. And especially for the conditioned Westerner, first worlder, that is like a relief. But it's also an imbalance, because if we don't also honor our humanity and our unique gifts and our beautiful idiosyncrasies and our laughter and our love and even our sexuality and our relationships and our feelings and our desire to just enjoy life, true and truly enjoy life.
It sounds to me like you are giving a whole workshop of my second book, Radical Personalism, here.
Exactly. Your book is...
I really emphasize that there, right? Humanity and divinity are not two separate streams. They have to be properly embraced and integrated. But yeah, I totally agree with the point you made, especially coming from Eastern traditions, and in the name of self-dedication, we engage in a type of self-forgetfulness which is not balanced. Yeah.
I just want to say your book is absolutely beautiful. I've been reading like parts of it. It is just exquisite.
I mentioned that just because I couldn't make a comparison. I didn't want you to make a live endorsement.
Not at all. I have it right here. I just want a little. This book is something very, very, very special. You have taken like everything that I have learned to dimensions that I am really looking forward. You know, they say put the feet of the Vaishnavas on our head.
Mm.
So the way I see the holy name is, like, in my life, I am engaged with my service.
Yeah.
But I am not engaged with Krishna Lila.
Mm.
Krishna Lila is like that is like above my head.
Yeah, but it's not something that you are denying or rejecting. It's just that you are working on your proper grounding, integrity, authenticity as a human. From what I can see, I don't want to speak for you, sir.
Exactly. It's like I have the holy name.
Mm-hmm.
This is a gift given to me by the devotees.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, in answer to this question, I took Harinam from Srila Govinda Maharaj.
Mm-hmm. Bhaktisundar Govind, Srila Bhaktisundar Govinda Maharaj, Siddhar Maharaj's disciple.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the holy name is like my lifeline.
Yeah, and you say you are not concerned with the Lila, but our tradition will say Nama, Rupa, Guna, Lila. So if the name is there and you're embracing that sincerely, will take you to Krishna's, from Krishna's name to Krishna's form, to Krishna's qualities, and to Krishna Lila. Whenever that has to happen, naturally, gradually. So
exactly. It's like everything is within the name.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I see it is like, if we are all trying to go back home, back to Godhead, and we are trying to leave here, and that's our focus, who will be left to comfort the suffering and feed mm-hmm. the hungry and help the children mm-hmm. and hug the elders? So I see that we are here for a reason. Mm-hmm. And if we can just remove the layers covering our spirit slowly, slowly, gradually, and then we can be a reflection of, because 99.999% of humanity will never meet any kind of saint or devotee.
Mm-hmm.
And so in our stumbling, humble, imperfect way, whatever we have gleaned from our maestros, from our teachers, you know, we can give it and we can share it and we can love. For me, and this is controversial, for me, my seva,
mm-hmm.
my puja,
mm-hmm.
is in service to the jivatmas and to beautiful humanity, rather than in the temple that is for the Brahmins. But for me, I am just kind of like on the outside, and it's like I would rather be in service, my own path, to Krishna in everybody's heart.
Yeah, that reminds me of one quote by Srila Prabhupada that I share in Radical Personalism. He will say, Krishna is everywhere, and wherever he is, that is his temple.
Exactly.
Which, of course, he says, and that's everywhere. So it's just the official temple, the building, is a reminder that the temple is everywhere.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I really appreciate your take on Bhakti, not as ritual alone or going on Sunday for Mass or the Sunday feast, but as life. And your seva is not just fulfilling certain dogmatic, doctrinal rules or whatever, but embodied, relational, rooted in land, rooted in people, rooted in humanity. And there are so many verses in our tradition that support what you are doing, just in case. It's not that you are, to be honest, I don't consider that controversial, in the sense that that's actually very present in our tradition, though I acknowledge that sometimes it's not that present for many people. And many times the main emphasis ends up being like an official formula. Go to the temple, go to the puja, do your donation, chant your rounds, and I have nothing against any of that. But there are so many ways to be a devotee, so many ways to be a lover of God. And yeah, to love God means to love everything that is in relationship to Him, and everything is in relationship to Him. So,
exactly. Yeah. I want to quickly go through my notes here. Just, yeah. You know, okay. Okay, this is something that is controversial.
No problem. Bring it to the table.
Okay. This is I have never spoken this before. I don't even know exactly how to say this, but it's like, this is something that's been on my heart for decades. You know, we are here in these bodies. Krishna has given us this life. And like I was saying, if we have our system is clogged and traumas and subluxations and parasites and our whole, you know, physical manifestation is out of whack, but we are all talking about high leelas in the highest plane of Goloka Vrindavan. Mm-hmm. It's like, I really feel like there's incredible value in like cleansing and freeing ourselves and healing ourselves so that our physical life, our embodiment is one of joy. In Sattva Gun, the actual physical body is pleasurable and spiritual pleasure just in existing, in our breath, in our connection with life. And so I think that is valuable.
Yeah, and that's a whole preliminary preparation for the higher reality of the Lila even. It's not like it's a separate project.
Exactly.
We are just putting the pieces together because the Lila, as I like to say, and thank you for those words, the Lila in our tradition will say Nara Lila. So the Lila is human. Krishna Lila, Krishna is divine, fully divine, but fully human. So I have to have my humanity fully in place. If not, if I'm going to a place which is fully divine, I'm fully human, and I'm not fully human. I'm disjointed, like fractured. It's like, I won't get it because these guys are fully human. I'm not fully human. We are talking different language. So
there's
a big place for having our humanity fully healed, integrated as part of the devotional Lila project, so to say.
Exactly. And really the holy name, when our physical, emotional, and mental vehicles, and we've done the inner work, the holy name becomes even sweeter because it's not being filtered through all of the blockages within our own system. Yes. And then it just becomes like the miracle. We realize what a miracle life is, mm-hmm. and that we've connected with the highest and we're here in humanity. And it's like, you know that song, like, now that we have love, what are we going to do? It's like, once we experience that love and that bhakti, it's just like, and then we see there are people around us that are suffering, and they are not going to join our religion. Mm-hmm. They are not going to be chanting our mantra. But they are going to love us. And we are going to love them. So they might not be able to receive the Maha Mantra.
Yeah. I get the point. Yeah.
They might not be able to receive the blessing of Yeshua. Mm-hmm. But in our own small, imperfect way, we can give them a hug. We can feed somebody. We can help somebody. We can take someone to a clinic. We can give someone an education. We can become their friend.
Yeah, and in one sense, all that love and service is unmotivated in terms of, I'm not loving you, so you get converted to my religion, which many times that has been the case. Okay, I open a hospital, I open a school, but the plan behind that is you have to join my group, my party. You know? So the fact that one is not looking for that, it makes the whole thing even more selfless in terms of, I just want to serve, to give, to love. Yeah. It's not that I'm waiting for when you start chanting Hare Krishna. It's like, that's something else. That doesn't need to happen for me, as you say, for me to love you and for you to love me. So,
because it's that relationship. And to the extent that we are feeling and experiencing and embodying whatever it is, the grace of our practice or the holy name or the bhakti or what our love for Yeshua, Jesus, whatever it might be, to the extent that we're embodying that, we can share that love without them having to join our religion.
Yeah. And that's a very definition of love. It's universal. It's not exclusivistic, sectarian, conditional. The condition being join my religion. Yeah.
Exactly.
Really appreciate that. Thank you.
Exactly.
What's there is in the list, Anand?
Okay, just moving right along here, that even the doorway to like the the sweetest realm of Goloka Vrindavan.
Mm-hmm.
That doorway, it's not like we have to leave, like we were saying, like you were saying, it's not like we have to leave here to go somewhere else in time and space. We just peel away the layers to mm-hmm. our own heart, our own bhakti, and we realize it's actually here. It's mm-hmm. actually here. And what is the souls of this world longing for more than that sweet love and friendship, that sweet love, divine love? And yes, obviously, this is not Goloka Vrindavan, but Goloka Vrindavan is just the innermost realm of consciousness. So all we have to do is keep chanting and keep peeling away and cleansing the levels of all of our karma and our mental and emotional and all of the levels. And just if we can just, it's just like that door of Goloka. That's when I'm chanting, I'm just like, Krishna, Krishna. And mm-hmm. it's like that name is like the key to the door of the sweetest inner realm. And that inner realm is within our own hearts. And if we can just touch that just once in our hearts, that sweetness that we are loved and that we are part of that love, and then we can go out into the world, our communities, and just love those around us, give them just a faint, faint, distant taste of that love. What more service can we do in this world but to just in our own sincere prayers be searching for that realm that we know is there, because the acharyas have told us so, and we have that faith. And once in a blue moon, we have that taste. And if we can just find that taste and find that little connection with that realm of Goloka and of the Vaishnavas that is just waiting for us, not somewhere else, not outside, not in the future, not when we're in going back to Godhead somewhere else, but within our own hearts. And that's what I'm always thinking, like here and now, wow. I have this sweet name of Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I have that name, and that name will cleanse my heart. I have that faith. And if I keep chanting that name with faith, then that will be revealed. We've been told that will be revealed. If we keep chanting that sweet name with faith and patience, it may take lifetimes. For me, it will take lifetimes. But if we can just get that little taste of sweetness, and then we can share it with others, what more service can we do in this world but uplift humanity? If we think of like where the world is right now and how sad and lost and lonely this world is right now. And if we can just, that's why we do our practice. That's why we do our sadhana. So we can offer that to our brothers and sisters. And that's why I do my sadhana. So that was one of my notes.
Amen, Sanan. Thanks so much. Beautiful. Very touching and very real, very real. It overflows very transparently through you. So it cannot but be true. And it's as you say, yeah, if it doesn't begin here and now, it doesn't begin anywhere else. No, I mean, it's whatever I want to attain starts in the here and now. And like Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, who is someone very dear to both of us, he will say, perfection is everywhere. It's not like a future attainment in a distant location, but it's here now. And however we navigate our life here now, that will speak about where we are going, right? So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
He will say, Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. And you very beautifully put it, like the innermost True. Realm of consciousness. So it's not like a physical, we are being taken by his mothership to another planet geographically, but it's a movement, in inner movement of in consciousness. It's a shift.
Srila Sridhar Maharaj talks so eloquently about these same topics.
Yes.
and also, it's not that we are just, you know, trying to cleanse and taste that within ourselves and then share it, but then we will actually reflect it. But to the extent that we, in any given moment, in our rocky, humble, very wavering, imperfect journey, But whatever we are resonating, whatever we are living, is what we will not only be sharing, but reflecting in others. It's just like if somebody's in joy, then those around, if you notice, if you're laughing in authentic joy, those around you will start
It's contagious.
If you see someone who's in love, you will just resonate. It's that contagion.
Exactly. So, like someone will say, like Sri Chaitanya was an embodiment of love, and people will say, that all his tremblings and seizures and convulsions was just epilepsy. But the argument about that is like epilepsy is not contagious.
Exactly.
Whatever he embodied was contagious.
Exactly.
We are all invited to be on some form or another, on some level, a type of embodiment.
Yeah. Exactly.
Love, service of the divine to one another.
Exactly. And if we look at the world with the wars and all of the tragedies happening and all the sadness, even the little bit that we might have, we might think like, I have to become enlightened, or I have to become, fully realized or some pure devotee. But the world cannot wait for us to become a pure devotee, for us to share anything, literally anything.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, because this idea of first I have to become perfect in order to then only then do something is like a recipe for frustration, and also for basically not doing your contribution to the world and to the system. And as I write in my recent book that I published, the third one is, perfection is not a fixed maximum. So you can always become more perfect and more loving. So at the end of the day, it's not I'm in point A and I have to reach point B and game over. But it's a constant unfolding and expansion and evolution of dedication and love. So, and we are already doing that on some level, and we will continue to do that forever. So, it's an ongoing journey. It never ends.
Exactly. It's a living process.
Yes.
And really, a big part of that living process is really loving and accepting ourselves when we're in the depths. Not trying to hold on to any state or any concept or any image or any social media image. It's just really like being able to surf through all the levels.
Thank you for bringing self-acceptance to our awareness and self-love as an aspect of love, because sometimes, even in the name of loving guru, loving Krishna, loving others, we end up neglecting ourselves. And as I like to say, love has to be loving in every direction. So if I love you, I have to love you in a way that is loving to me as well. I cannot love God and hate myself. So which happens a lot, by the way.
Exactly. That is the extreme dysfunction that happens even in a bhakti path, when we want to love and then we forget ourselves because we have to. Exactly, brother. Thank you. Exactly. This is so important. This is the integration of really, like the self-care and the personal growth. And because we can only eventually, that self-care really disappears. Mm-hmm. We have to maintain ourselves, but we don't need to be fixated with ourselves.
Yeah.
But the more that we're nourishing ourselves and eating well and honoring our needs and taking care of ourselves along with our spiritual practices, and that we are whole, then that's when we're good to go.
Yeah, and seeing ourselves not as a separate unit, no? So it's not that I'm taking care of myself again in a narcissistic, self-centered, selfish way, but I'm interconnected with everyone else. So whatever I'm doing for my self-care is a way of being a better offering in service to others as well, right? So there's no like separation.
Exactly, absolutely, because we are that same Jivatma, we are that same source that we are being in service to. And sometimes some of us have become people pleasers in the name of bhakti and lose ourselves in the name of service, and then we have to come back to ourselves before we can continue on.
Yeah, So yeah, I really appreciate that the middle point always, not to go to the extreme of individualism and it's all about me and I'm the center, but also in the name of dedication, neglecting ourselves in a toxic way, but find the sweet spot in the middle point always. Balance, again, balance, such an important.
Exactly.
So we wrap up, Shannon, any other point you have there in the list or something urgent to be shared today?
We have completely covered all of my notes.
We have. Wow. I'd like to finish then asking you maybe one, two questions. One is, of course, I can clearly see how important it is for you, not only the word service, but service as a lifestyle, right? Like the seeing yourself as an identity for you, right? I'm a servant. I'm of service to the community, to everyone. So, and bhakti is another way of speaking about service. Srila Prabhupada will translate as devotional service. So I don't like to separate between one thing or the other. It's not that, okay, so devotional service is in the compound of the temple and outside that, it's service. It all depends from which place you are doing it. So what does bhakti mean to you today? That's my question. Bhakti as service. Today, not yesterday, not tomorrow, but today. What does bhakti means, a life of service mean to Sanan?
For me, it is receiving the vision that I have to be of service to my community here. Mm-hmm. And on a practical level, that means each day taking the next little tiny step. Mm. So I'm going through my practices and I am in my little apartment. And then I go out on the street and I am seeing and connecting with people who know me. Mm-hmm. So I am in a village where everyone knows me. Mm-hmm. In the history of my village, I have been told that there has never been an expat, extranjero.
Mm-hmm. Like a foreign.
Foreigner that has ever become part of my village as mm-hmm. I have. Mm-hmm. So as I go down the street, everyone knows me by name.
Yeah.
And the children come up and they hug me. Mm. And just throughout the simple daily life of my life here, I'm continually connecting with everybody. And then I go to the school and there are the teachers. Like right now, the classes are going on. As we've had this conversation here on Monday, we've had English class, music class. Right now, yoga class finished at 5 o'clock. Oh. And art class is from 5 to 6 o'clock.
Okay.
So I will go to the school, I will see the teachers, I go to the school, the children all hug me, we see what materials I need to buy, what dramas or issues I have to deal with. There's a dog.
That's community life, of course.
It's very simple, it's very mundane, but because of the love that is infused within all of it.
Yeah, it's extraordinary in its own way, of course.
It's extraordinary in its own way.
Yeah.
And so that is my life and that is my bhakti, that is my devotional service, is just taking care of myself so I can be in good form.
Please.
And then being in relationship with my village. This is my little Vrindavan. And I am in service to the devotees here because for me, they are all very pure spirits, very pure souls here. Mm. And so I feel incredibly honored that I get to live. I mean, I am going to spend the rest of my life here. I have surrendered to being in this village. Okay. I have friends in Costa Rica, in Maui, in Thailand. I have many friends in Bali. You know, I could have gone to any of these places and lived a, in many ways, more
comfortable life.
Very much so. It's very austere. It's very austere here in many ways. But what I've realized is that even more than that tropical paradise, that the frequency, the essence of love that I have with my village and my service and the children and their love for me and their trust in me, because I have given everything that I have. And so I have built this love and this trust, and that relationship, that sweetness of relationship and service, and the simple joys of everyday life is even more sweeter than the most tropical Hawaiian Costa Rican paradise.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that back to relationship at the end of the day, to the day-to-day sharing in community, in village, with simplicity, with quote-unquote mundanality, but all that held in a very extraordinary setting of trust and bond and love. So, and for me, again, as you say, that's your little Vrindavan. And when you read the descriptions of Vrindavan in the scripture, it sounds quite ordinary in many ways. Again, it's like an uncivilized tribal village. But when you pay closer attention, there's like, wow, this is so sweet, so intimate, so much love and care and each other has for each other. So basically, that's what we are invited to replicate on Earth in our day to day. If we want to enter and understand such a place, why not to start living in such a place as much as we can in our relationships? Yeah,
like in Vrindavan, they forget. They forget, the devotees in Vrindavan forget that Krishna is Bhagavan.
Yeah, even Krishna forgets that he's Bhagavan. Imagine that one.
So they are just living a simple village life.
Yeah, with the daily ordinary concerns.
This is happening. That's
the topmost transcendence for us.
That we totally forget, exactly. We totally forget all of the high leelas and all of the, you know, the Om Shantis and, you know, I am such a this or a that. Mm-hmm. And it just becomes like the living, simple, human. It's just very, it's not externally even spiritual. But it's so sweet because those relationships and those connections are so sweet. Just like, and that's how I see it. Like in Vrindavan, they forget and they are just living their life. They are just absorbed in cooking and cleaning and, you know, maybe where is Krishna, you know?
Yeah.
But, and so that is such a high ideal. And, you know, we can be in a very spiritual community or in a yoga ashram or in some new age ashram, and everybody is like very spiritual.
At least overtly.
But I would rather be in my very messy, messy, very almost dirty and messy and human little village.
Yeah, and even know that Krishna is there, even there, no? So that's the thing, the important realization, right? I always remember a quote that I always share from Thomas Merton. He was a Christian Trappist monk, and he said, your salvation begins in the most ordinary moments of your daily life.
Exactly. And, you know, once in a while in those moments, I will just like remember Krishna in the most mundane moments and realize what a gift I have received by being able to be part of my village like this.
What a gift. And to be honest, I look forward at some point, my own journey, visiting you all there and having a further glimpse. You have tempted me enough now with all these beautiful descriptions, and you have a glimpse of that beautiful experience. So, Sanam, before concluding, anything you would like to leave our audience in the hearts of those listening? Any final conclusion, thoughts, whatever you may like to share before we put our conversation to rest?
I just want to apologize that I understand that my communication is very rough. And
you say you are not accustomed to do podcasts and all that, but it's a pleasure to have you as a guest. You're very natural, spontaneous, heartfelt. That's for me the best possible type of podcast guest, just in case. Yeah.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I will repeat before we conclude again, those who would like to contact the nonprofit that Sanan has is Amistad Sagrada, AmistadSagrada.com. Sacred Friendship in English, but the name is in Spanish, Amistad Sagrada. And for the latest updates of the community there, you can go to his Facebook page, which is Sanan Pisac, S-A-N-A-N-P-I-S-A-Q. Pisac, the name of the village in Peru there in Cusco. So, dear Sanan, thank you so much, dear brother. It has been such an honor and a pleasure to share this conversation with you. I'm looking forward to continue unfolding our bond, our connection, and service in whatever ways Krishna wants to reveal it. So thanks so much for coming today.
Brother Swamiji, thank you so very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.